it just dawned on me that rereading Genesis 1, where it sounds as though God created the earth first and everything else thereafter, because verse 17 of Genesis 1, God sent them in the firmaments of the heaven to give light on the earth and to rule, okay? And then he said, of two great lights, then he made the stars.
Yeah, it says that phrase, the Hebrew, simply, I think it's just two Hebrew words. The stars, stars also, the stars also.
All.
Yeah, yeah.
And then at the end it says, it was all done, it was all done, the beginning of chapter 2, right? That was it.
Yeah.
It was finished.
Yeah. And it was a perfect creation. It had given the green plants and the fruit-bearing trees for humans to eat and for the animals to eat. No hint of carnivorous animals at that point.
No, chapter 2, verse 1, thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right. And I see no reason not to take that at face value. For just the plain meaning of the words. Yeah. Okay.
I listened to a professor at Trinity College several months ago where he raised a hypothesis regarding the speed of light. He maintained that it's instantaneous and that we can't measure. So I take this, and he says, like you throw a ball, you're measuring it on a round trip. You try and have them at two different spots, your clocks aren't synchronized. Anyhow, where I'm going with this is the evolutionists talk about light years and the expanse and all of that. That is the big picture. The little one comes down to the 6 days of creation, and then less than 10,000 years of the Earth has existed. Do these all tie together somehow? As an explanation to an evolutionist about refuting speed of light and the other issue.
Okay. All right. So we've transitioned from language to cosmology here. So that's okay. That's okay. I, you know, for most of the time over the last 40 years, I've not given a lot of focus on cosmological issues. But this last summer, just in the last few months, I agreed to teach a course at Southern California Seminary on cosmology, astronomy and cosmology in the Bible was the title. So I've come up to speed a lot on cosmological issues and become, I think, fairly conversant with all the creation ideas and come to some of my own conclusions. One thing I find surprising is that the main creation, the people, cosmologists, the people that are working, trying to answer, especially this distant starlight problem, have all come to the same position. That's very amazing to me. That includes Russ Humphreys, it includes John Hartnett, it includes Jason Lyle, and I'm really not sure where Danny Faulkner falls on that. But the picture is, well, let me just mention Russ Humphreys' model. Basically, you have the days of creation you read about in Genesis 1. You have day 4 when the sun, moon, and stars are created. In Russ's model, the cause of this effect of gravitational time dilation, there's an instant where time stops on Earth during day 4. And during that time, light from all the stars in the galaxy, in all the galaxies, reach Earth simultaneously. And so, for one instant, there are no stars. The next instant, all the stars we see today, galaxies, you know, some of them you can't see with the naked eye. That light arrived at Earth. And, you know, he does it in the framework of general relativity. And basically, Jason Lyle has a similar, has what amounts to the same framework. And another guy that you haven't heard of yet, he's from Bulgaria, he's working on his PhD, a brilliant guy. He comes to this same conclusion, but through a little different route, but essentially the same idea, that all the light from all the stars arrive at an instant during day four on Earth. And all of these people I've met, and John Hartnett, I was on a tour of Israel with him and Russ Humphreys in May, a creation tour where we spoke in Messianic congregations there in Israel. And I discussed these ideas with John Hartnett, and he says, I concur. That's my position now. And so it appears that almost everybody, most people, most of the leading creationist cosmologists now have this view that there's a special way that God created all the stars. He created them just at the right time and place in the cosmos for their light to arrive simultaneously at the same instant on day four on planet Earth. And so that's my answer, or that's my position as well now.
I think that would be sort of similar to Danny Faulkner was here, and I sort of discussed that with him one time. And he did go into that sort of detail, but essentially so many miracles happened in creation week that this is essentially just another miracle. God made the stars, he wanted us to see them, so he created them in such a way that the light came out here.
And so I believe, you know, he says that these lights in the heavens were for days and months and signs and seasons. And so he created them for a purpose.
There's no point in them. And
if they weren't immediately visible, there would be no point in his making them. So I believe it sounds like Danny basically agrees also.
Is the term irreducible complexity come into this, where it says certain things did not have to be before, but they all came together in an instant?
Right. And so what I gave you with all these molecular machines was my version of irreducible complexity. It's irreducible complexity at such a level you can't even imagine that level of complexity. And it has to all be there at once. Yes?
Okay, these colorful schematics you had up there, what, ATP, etc. Can you tell me the name of a book or a DVD so I can go just with my family? Like, you got them somewhere.
Well, I taught a course a year ago at the seminary on Darwinism, and all these images were images I showed in class. And then I did a Sunday school class last spring in April at my church, and they videotaped all those lectures. And they're on the web. They're YouTube videos. And I can give you the web address. The web address, the name of the church is Grace Community Church, and that website is... No, that's a different Grace Community Church. It's in Ramona, California, not Panorama City, California. So it's... GCC Ramona, all one word, GCCRamona.com. That's our church's website. And so you click on, I think it's teaching and then videos. It could be the other way around, videos and teaching, but I think it's teaching and videos. And you look for my name. And there are five videos, because I did this over a period of 5 weeks. And all those images are in that YouTube. GCC Ramona, RAMONA.com. And by the way, I forgot I had another slide here. If you're interested in this talk that I just gave,
it's hard to see.
Can't see. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that's the time to see. The rest is good. Change up your color.
Maybe lights off. All right, hold on just. Hold on just a second. I'll fix it. Hold on in just a second.
Just change the color. Maybe twice.
Can you shut the light
off
for a second, Bob?
No, I was just going to make it white.
All right. So this is my own website. There's a lot of things there that you might be interested in. LogosResearchAssociates.org. And then you want to click on the tab About Us, and then on John Baumgartner, and then there's one called More Information, and then look for the paper entitled A Linguistic Argument for God's Existence. And this is was published in 2015 in JETS, which is the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, and it's basically very close to what I presented today in that paper. I'll just leave that on the screen for you. And we talked about a little bit, why isn't this information out there? Well, I published this paper in a fairly widely read theological journal, and, I really have gotten a surprisingly little response.
Probably because thousands and thousands of churches capitulated.
Yes.
And want to include evolution in Genesis.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
I have maybe a suggestion just off the top of my head. Maybe this lack of response is because Christianity and the Western civilization is in decline. Have you tried to present that among Christians in other cultures? Like Asia?
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. That's an excellent idea. I agree. Well, I did. I published in 2009, and the reference is in this paper, in a book published by a Jewish guy that had a lot of. Most of the articles were hostile toward Christianity in this volume, that didn't generate much response either. So, anyway, yes.
How about more general Christian magazines and things, like Christianity Today, things like that, and then make it that it's more for everyday people like us.
Yeah.
And then have as your reference, amongst others, as your reference,
more scholarly,
paper, whatever
you call it. Yeah, that's
for those that are more, scientifically minded or technically minded, they want a little bit more detail,
Well, I'm finite. I there's just so many things I can do, my wife tells me I say yes too easily, like I said yes to this tour to Canada. it's a matter of priorities. But these are good ideas, and it would be helpful if I had some fans that could help. Ghostwrite for me, or help me, produce some stories for Christianity Today, and other venues like that. So anyway, pray for me. I agree that that's, you know, I don't want to be negative, but at one point I was employed by one of the main creation organizations. That organization changed leadership and basically fired all of its scientists. And so I've been unemployed as a creationist ever since. Yes.
That stuff doesn't even touch what you're talking about. Like, it just glosses over, and you don't really understand what she was talking about. But this is like, it makes sense. And comparing it to nursing, like, hey, it really makes sense, you know? And it's like we are missing out on so much. And maybe creation science answers Genesis can have. Maybe somehow we can get you in this thing.
Well, at one point, I think I even am still on the Answers in Genesis speakers list. I'm not sure or not. But, you know, surprisingly, they don't invite me to speak. For I don't know why. Pardon? Oh, George? Do you have a question?
Oh, may I speak?
Oh, sure.
We have a DVD and a book on the what people are asking about. DVD is called Wonder of the Cell by Georgia Perner. Wonder of the Cell into all these machinery that you see there.
It does touch it compared to what John has done.
It isn't as detailed. It's very popular. And the other is the book called Design and Complexity of the Cell.
That doesn't either.
Yeah, I think the whole issue of information, as a Christian, as an issue of Christian apologetics, is pretty recent, isn't it?
Well,
I think ultimately this is going to be the greatest stumbling block for evolution.
Yeah,
is information.
Let me just say that Werner Goetz has been seeking to make many of the points that I made today for 30 years, but his training is as an engineer, and so his approach to this topic is from an engineering approach, electrical engineering approach, where the linguistic aspects are omitted. He tried to add those on, but the basic structure made it very difficult. So what I've done, what my friend John Aller, who's a linguist, did, is use the linguistic terminology, a linguistic approach. And to me, that's a much more powerful approach to communicate these things, rather than from a Shannon information electrical engineering perspective. And I even worked with Werner when he was revising his book back about 8 years ago, and I strongly appealed to him to switch to the linguistic terminology. And I spent, you know, weeks editing his book to try to help him do that. And in the end, he decided to ignore all of that.
He's German.
Yeah, he's German.
I have a thought here. I think if I heard correctly earlier on, you've worked on the tectonic plates, which has evolved into the weather system. Here on the West Coast, there's been a lot of discussion recently over the big ones, the big earthquake. And I'm just wondering, there could be a linkage, because this has really got people's interest, and the aspect of the tectonic plates that led to the flood, and in fact, the Bible is real. And it just seems to me sometimes, if you can make that a common level that has everybody's interest, maybe that approach, just a thought.
Yeah, well, I gave a talk on that last night. I'm giving another one this evening. You know, it's probably not what you want to hear living where you're living. But the plate, the Wanda Fuca plate is locked, with the North American plate, and there's year by year the stress is building. And that locked zone can only tolerate so much stress before it gives way.
So if we had a few little ones, that would help them, right?
It might. It might just make the big one come quicker.
I have some cheap real estate for you.
I live on the Pacific Coast myself. I live down in San Diego. It's easy for me to deceive myself that, I'm somewhat far away from the San Andreas and also from the Newport Fault that runs on the other side underneath LA. So either one, the potential is pretty large for a big earthquake. And there's several faults around LA that could lead to a big earthquake. The risk right where I live is relatively low compared with most parts of Southern California. So I say, well, I don't need to worry about it. But, every few weeks we have a tremor that we feel, and they happen so often, especially with my background in geophysics, that there are two types of waves. There are body waves that move rapidly and surface waves that move more slowly. So usually, depending on how far away the earthquake is, the more separation there is between the body wave and the surface wave. So if I can get already have an intuitive feel for, I can time the body waves basically cause the mountains to groan and creak, and so I can hear that sound and know that there's an earthquake about to happen from the body waves. But it's the surface waves that cause the motion, the shaking. So I have maybe typically 2 or 3 seconds before the shaking begins that I can know when the earthquakes happen. And again, by the time difference, I can estimate how far away it is, whether it's 30 miles or 50 miles or 100 miles away. So the last one that really shook us was on Easter Sunday. When was that? About 5 years ago. It was down in Mexicali on the Mexican border, about 100 miles east of San Diego. And nothing broke in our house, but it was a pretty good shaking. But it was moderately far away, so that's about the distance that I would estimate that a big one could happen. So it's far enough away that, if it's, depending on just how big it is, we probably would not suffer huge damage. But anyway, I'm saying that from talking to a few people here, you don't have so frequent earthquakes like we do. But anyway, it causes us constantly to be aware that things are shifting, there's small slips on faults all over the place, and that the risk is genuine.
So what about the solar? We have now, we're monitoring the sun like we have never been before. Is there a connection between the geological and the sun's activities?
Are you talking about earthquakes?
Yeah,
and correlation?
I mean, the fact that the sun has that much of an impact.
There's discussion as to how much influence does the sun have on climate, and there are people that are indicating that that they believe that the sun is the major thing responsible for changing global temperature. The point that I tend to make in this debate is that one thing that most climate scientists haven't taken into account is that the system was designed by God. And God built in a lot of feedback to produce stability, climate stability. The climate scientists don't think about that or haven't thought about that or, you know, it's not part of their model that there are feedback mechanisms. And it appears that one basic mechanism is that as you have more, greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, we tend to trap more infrared and raise the temperature, that is compensated by more cloudiness in the tropics that reflect solar radiation back to space and don't let it reach the Earth. So it appears, and when I was involved, the last several years I was at Los Alamos, I was actually funded by climate change money. So I was working on a global ocean weather forecast model. And so I went to the climate meeting, so I was very much involved. And one thing that everybody, I think, was very much aware of is how inadequate the cloud models were in these climate models. That it was flying by the seat of the pants. Basically, the resolution we had was one grid point, typically every few hundred kilometers. So it became, you can't model thunderstorms, you can't model individual clouds, so you've got to, what's called parameterize that, come up with some kind of approximation for what these, but that's a highly, what's called nonlinear process. So it's really tricky to get that right. And most people that are involved in that acknowledge that it's what we have is really a very crude approximation. And so it's not surprising that they were not able to capture this feedback effect. Okay.
I have two questions, small questions. One of them, just out of curiosity, at Los Alamos, are you working in essentially the same facilities that they did the Manhattan Project in?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. I was in the in the theoretical division, which was the most prestigious division at the laboratory. And when I was originally hired, I was hired into a computational fluid dynamics group. And, you know, that might sound innocent enough, but, microseconds even, a nuclear device essentially becomes a fluid. So the main, historically, the reason for that group was to predict the behavior of nuclear weapons. So the first year or so, some of the projects I worked on was to develop better numerical methods for doing those calculations. It was only the first few years that I did that kind of work, and mostly after that I started doing work relating to climate modeling.
And second question, you said you came to Christ while you were at the university?
Yes.
So were you before that a fairly fervent atheist or just a...
No, I was not. I basically grew up on a farm in West Texas. But my parents were not Christians. My dad for sure wasn't a Christian. He was more or less an agnostic college professor. So we almost never went to church as a family. My mother grew up in church, So that most of the influence that I had was through my mother, but I didn't.
What brought you?
All right.
To Christ.
What brought me to Christ? I believe God brought me to Christ. He used, it was mainly for social reasons that I visited this Sunday school class. I normally didn't have very high regard for college Sunday school classes. I thought that these people were, you know, not wacko, but just naive, you know, just. Anyway, like I said, it was primarily some interest in some girls that I.
God used that.
And that was the first time I'd ever been in a group of people, you know, of intelligent people that were carefully studying the Word of God. And the week that I went was the second week in a verse-by-verse study of the Gospel of John. And so that first week, they were still in the prologue of John, the first 18 verses. And the first thing the teacher did was ask people on one row, everybody, he said, read two verses, just read two verses, and if you have any comments, you know, you're welcome to make your comments on the verses. So it turned out that I was sitting on that row, and my verses were the last two, 17 and 18 of John 1, which say, grace and the law came through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No man has seen God at any time. The only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. All right. I picked up the Bible a few times, you know, just couldn't get anything out of it. Anyway, I read my two verses, and I felt like a complete dummy. I had no idea what those verses might be talking about. And whereas all these other people seem to be, you know, making profound, having profound insights. Okay. Anyway, but I found it intriguing. How did these kids, and I was in graduate school at that point, most of these kids were undergraduates, how did these kids understand the Bible when it's just so impossible for me to understand? And also I saw there was some quality in these kids that I saw. There seemed to be a freedom and a peace, and I couldn't put my finger on what it was, but it was something attractive, something that I didn't have in my life that I had a sense that I needed. So anyway, I decided to come back the next week, and then the next week, and after a while, I even went out and bought myself. The only Bible I'd ever seen was a King James, and I saw these kids had a more modern translation. And I said, well, maybe it's the translation. So so anyway, and then at some point I found out that a lot of the kids were involved with a group on campus called Campus Crusade for Christ. I started dropping in on some of those meetings and heard some talks. I remember one, the talk was, did Jesus really rise from the dead? And I said, you know, that's a good question. I never thought about that. That's how it reflects how little background I had. And again, I met more of these kids that I found, you know, really intriguing to understand what made them tick. And so it took about 3 months of going verse by verse through the Gospel of John. At one point, I realized what the main topic was, and that was, who is Jesus? Is he for real or not? Is he authentic or not? And when I realized that, I said, you know, that's a good question. That has never been on my radar screen. as an important intellectual question to address. Yeah, and so in James it talks about, or Peter, in 1 Peter it talks about us being begotten again by the living and abiding Word of God. I look at that experience in that Sunday school class of the Word of God, my being exposed to it in a major way in John's Gospel. And I believe the Holy Spirit took that, and it had its certain result. And there was a point where I came to realize, to conclude, that Jesus had to be authentic, had to be who he claimed to be. But then it was a weekend retreat where I had another realization that it wasn't just enough to have that, have the head knowledge about that, but that a personal transaction between me and Jesus was the next step. I had not ever understood that before. And so I didn't make, at that retreat, I didn't actually take that step. But then, I think it was Wednesday night after I came back, I decided to do that. And just a simple prayer, Jesus, I want what you're offering. It was something very simple like that, but it was a transaction with him. And so I didn't know enough to even expect my life to be any different. So it was a big surprise in the next day, in the next two or three days, to see all of a sudden I had insights that I had never seen before. It was like a curtain pulled back on a dimension I'd never even suspected to exist. And I found myself with an intense desire to read the New Testament, and started reading through the New Testament about once a week, and started going to a Christian bookstore and buying these books, authors like Francis Schaeffer, C.S. Lewis, and reading typically one of those books a week. All the time I was in an intense graduate program. But it was the most exciting discovery that I'd ever made. And I started experimenting with prayer. And you know, I had a financial need, and I prayed about it. And within a couple of days, saw an answer. And so with my scientific training, I said, you know, is this just a coincidence, or is this really God answering prayer? And so I went back and forth. I mean, I struggled with that, you know. And I finally concluded that the best answer is that it's an answer to prayer. And so, like I said, just I grew extremely rapidly in my understanding, in my faith. So at one point, that just opened up, just opened a whole new outlook for me. And at one point, I decided to drop out of graduate school. And it was during the Vietnam time. I'd gone through ROTC, Reserve Officer Training Program, when I was in undergraduate. And in doing that, I had acquired a 4-year obligation to serve in the Air Force. So I decided to go ahead and get that active duty commitment out of the way. So I was assigned to the U.S. Air Force. And again, because of all the technical training I had, I was assigned to a research lab doing work on the biggest lasers the United States had, and a very heady kind of research, putting the development of what was called the Airborne Laser Laboratory, putting a large laser in an aircraft with a pointing and tracking system to demonstrate that we could shoot down missiles from aircraft with lasers. And I was involved in designing the optics for that laser, and the laser was built, did perform according to spec, and that the success of that program basically was the basis that Ronald Reagan used to get his Star Wars approved about 5 years later. So it was pretty heavy work, but a pretty heavy duty kind of science. But it was probably some of the richest time spiritually for me, because I had all kinds of opportunities to do Christian ministry there in the Air Force. And so I ended up deciding, I sensed God had his hand on me, calling me to something. I couldn't quite know what it was. So I ended up, instead of going to seminary, I applied to several seminaries and just didn't have peace about doing it. Decided to join the staff of Campus Crusade, was on the campus of the University of Kentucky for 2 years, got very involved in doing creation evolution lectures, just sort of spontaneously happened. And in the third year, they encouraged me to go to their headquarters to work on, to make this these materials I put together transferable. And it was during that time I was able to work on some of the difficult issues, like what about plate tectonics and the flood. And I had this epiphany that the flood had to be a tectonic catastrophe. And I realized that was so significant I couldn't imagine, because all my training had been in electrical engineering at that point, that God would call me to do something about that. But I discovered that he had, and I left Campus Crusade to get a PhD in geophysics at UCLA, and he opened unbelievable doors to me, including the opportunity to do my PhD research at Los Alamos and to develop a state-of-the-art model for the Earth's interior, which in the literature it was said that it was at least 10 years away. It's through a method that a mathematician there introduced me to. And basically that catapulted me into the inner circles of the international geophysics community. And and it opened the door for a position at Los Alamos. And when they interviewed me, they knew I was a creationist. I'd given a public lecture there. And I was amazing. These non-Christian guys, after the interviews, well, the second interview spent over an hour talking about spiritual things. He wanted to understand my flood model. I got to evidently off onto how common traditions of the flood were existed in all these cultures. And I hadn't said very much at that point about the Bible. So he said, well, what about the Bible? What do you believe about the Bible? So I shared with him my conversion experience. I shared with him the gospel message. And he was very respectful. Said, one of my friends has been telling me a lot of these same things. Anyway, at the end of that interview, it was all about creation and the Bible and spiritual things. At the end of that interview, and I was saying, I came back afterwards and said, that's a really unusual interview. at the end of that interview, apparently the two of them had gone to the division leader and earnestly implored him to create a position for me. And later that afternoon, they got back with me saying that he had approved this position. And part of the offer, this was a permanent position in the most prestigious division of the laboratory. Part of the offer was to allow me to work half-time on my own research, knowing what my research agenda was. And the thought that went through my mind is, I thought of the scripture in Proverbs, God turns the hearts of kings like streams of water. Something like that had to be going on with these non-Christian scientists to make me that kind of offer. So, indeed, I enjoyed that kind of freedom to work on my own research up until the end of the Cold War for about 6 years. And that time was when I started publishing on catastrophic plate tectonics. So it's been an incredible adventure ever since. I had this dramatic conversion experience, and it was triggered by this kind of exposure to the Gospel of John.
Both of which start in creation and go from creation to Christ. And that is what God is for.
So I believe these creation issues are right at the cutting edge of defending the faith in the 21st century. I know that's the viewpoint of Recreation Science Association. So I think I'm getting a little weary. I've got another talk to do. I'm gonna sign off for now. But thank you for your interest. Thank you for all the good questions.